This is an ABC podcast.
AusYA.
So Monuments is about a group of three teenagers who skip school and venture around Sydney to find the ancient gods hidden underneath a series of schools.
Now, Will, this is your first fantasy book, and it's the first book in a duology. Mm-hmm. How did your love of fantasy books and fantasy video games influence this story?
So, I grew up absolutely obsessed with Terry Pratchett. I think that's where I get a lot of my rude humour from. the world of Tolkien, and also just obsessed with video games like The Legend of Zelda. But I would play those games and, you know, read those books, watch those films, and really wish that we had something like that set in Australia. And this book is the culmination of 10 years of me just daydreaming on trains, my head against the glass, just imagining what would it be like if in contemporary Sydney there was this huge, epic fantasy story that unfolded.
Well, how much did that guide you, Will, in terms of what you've learnt from playing fantasy video games and some of the cliches that pop up in that a bit to maybe those things that you expect to find in a fantasy novel?
So, for me, I remember one of the first big video games that I ever played was Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. And that was back when cutscenes in video games were quite rare. And I remember this one cutscene of gods creating the world, and I thought, wow. And I kept going back, replaying the game just to see that one cutscene again. And I guess that planted sort of the seed in my mind. And I thought, okay, I want to work with gods. I want to work with an alternate sort of world where, with its own creation myth, and have that all play out in Sydney. So I've basically spent the last 10 or 12 years going back to that cutscene that made my jaw drop as a child and think, okay, what's a way that I could take a story like that and smash it together with what I usually write, which is contemporary realistic fiction.
Will, at the start of Monuments, we meet Connor Giannopoulos, who has mm-hmm. two N's in his first name and two N's in his last name. But why is he divorcing his friend Ollie? What's happening, and where do we find Connor at the start of this book?
Well, he isn't actually the one doing the divorcing. He has been divorced. So his friend has told him, look, you're kind of boring, go sort yourself out. And so he wants to prove he's not boring, and he does that in the most boring way possible, and his friend ignores him. And so he decides, you know what, that's it. I'm going to do the unthinkable. I'm going to skip first period. And so he ends up chilling in a disused stairwell in his high school, eating contraband, and he eventually knocks a chocolate-coated almond on the floor, goes to retrieve it, and he finds a trapdoor that leads him deep underneath his school.
And Will, when he ventures into this chamber underneath, he then sort of gets found by Sally. What is Sally's job in all of this?
Well, Sally is on an adventure, and he's just sort of the collateral damage, and he sort of manages to ingratiate himself into her story, and then slowly it becomes his story. But she's down there because she's looking for the gods, and he is someone who is just in her way, but he eventually becomes a helpful hurdle, and he helps her solve a puzzle and rotate this chamber 180 degrees. And after he falls more gracefully than he expects from the ceiling, they awaken a god, and that sort of launches them on an adventure. And whether they like it or not, they are now in this together.
And speaking of being together, Will, I mean, you have put a little bit of romance in here. And the third part of this adventure journey is Lockie, who Connor is just a little bit taken by him as soon as he sort of
just
sees
very, Lockie. Very taken. Like, it is, there is no time wasted. It goes from zero to thirst. Connor is parched. And look, I wanted to, in Monuments, I wanted to write a story that would have really set my world on fire as a teenager who was sort of struggling with his sexuality and all that sort of stuff. And when I'm writing contemporary novels, I found that while they do explore identity, usually those parts of our identity, and we celebrate that representation, that identity that we explore, we end up finding the negatives of it, and it's mostly people crying about who they are, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
and so
sure.
If I'm expected to write, you know, a gay book, it's always about somebody who's struggling to come out or someone who's struggling to find themselves, or it's about a kid struggling against racism, and all those things are really, really important and really potent, but it gets to the point where it's like, let me just play my suffering for you, and then when I'm done, everybody clap. That's exhausting after a while. So I knew going into Monuments, I wanted to write, you know, a queer love story that is fun, uncomplicated, well, to a point, but just something that was really sweet. And I wanted to prove myself that I could write, like, a really wonderful love story. And I also set myself the target of, I don't want this to end in tragedy. Like, I have a penchant for tragedy. Anyone who reads any of my books is like, oh, this is not going to end well. But I want people to know, sort of going in, that their love, whatever they build, is sacred. And, you know, there'll be challenges across two books for sure. But I just want people to know that this is not going to be one of those gay stories where it ends in a Romeo and Juliet moment.
So, well, I mean, for you, is that important in terms of having characters like Connor and Lockie, where you don't have to set them up? They're already doing what they're doing. They know roughly who they are, but you didn't feel the need to have to set down all that groundwork that you normally, I don't know if it's a thing that you see quite often, but I get what you're saying about the coming out stories, mm-hmm. and those stories needing to have that as the catalyst rather than just two gay characters going on an adventure.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, you know, we never have, when we have two straight sort of protagonists, we're never like, oh, I can't wait for them to come out as straight and then eventually find each other. We never have, there's never that hurdle. And I wanted to show it. Look, the reality is, being a queer person in Australia, there's still some complications there. There are still things that we have to sort of overcome. And that is the reality of it. But you know what? I've explored that reality in my most recent book, The Sidekicks, and I wanted to write a story that didn't have that baggage. Just, you know, give queer kids who were like me growing up, kids who are sort of figuring out who they are, and even kids who aren't queer and who their friends are queer, give them a story that doesn't just show the pity party, or it doesn't show them having to overcome this great ordeal to then go on an adventure. That shouldn't be a prerequisite for us if we want to go out and save the world.
Well, it seems to me that Connor's dealing with bigger things than that anyway, mm-hmm. that he's dealing with self-confidence,
yeah.
that he feels as though he's not exciting enough to be with in terms of friendship, you know, and yeah. struggling with the way that Ollie's kind of cut him off, and he's had this 3 weeks to try to work out how does he get Ollie back as a friend. But I think there's a moment in the book where they have to pick out name tags, and he picks up a name tag, Brent, and goes, mm-hmm. oh, but I don't feel like I'm a Brent. So all the way through this, he's kind of struggling with finding who he is, but having the confidence in that. And Lockie kind of helps that a bit, doesn't
yeah.
he? And is that because, I mean, do you think that's because Connor can see sort of, you know, Lockie is a bit older, and he can see that there are possibilities that he's not always going to be this way. He doesn't have to be this way.
Well, for me, I just wanted to sort of show just how love can set someone free. And, you know, Connor is just, he is almost completely uninhibited when he meets Lockie, and it's this sort of spur of the moment, I will never meet you again. So he's not overthinking it. When we meet him, like, the first few chapters are quite dense because you see Connor is just overthinking absolutely everything. And as the story goes on and he gets swept up in this adventure, he doesn't really have time to think about stuff anymore. And that's when he's allowed to live more comfortably. And, you know, Lockie, they just keep bouncing off each other, and they keep bringing out the best of each other. And I really just wanted to show, look, since I wrote The Sidekicks, I have fallen in love. And, you know, that sort of...
Congratulations.
You know, thank you. No, I should congratulate him. I'm amazing. But, you know, I want to show that, you know, just having someone there who is your safety net and who looks out for you, that lifts you up. And, you know, Connor doesn't have that friendship at the beginning of the book, let alone the romance. He doesn't have a friend who lifts him up, you know, and that affects him in a negative way. And the book is sort of, yes, he finds his way to stand on his own two feet, but at the same time, he's also learning to be part of a trio and to be part of a healthier friendship.
Will, is it true that you wanted to write this book initially with no villains?
Yes. Oh, and it was a mess. But, like, look, I'm a sucker for, like, setting myself a bar that's way too hard to clear and then whacking my head on that bar. But the big thing was I wanted them to have caused a lot of their misfortunes. Again, there's that me and my sucker, me being a sucker for a tragedy coming through there. But, you know, that I tried that and I ended up with a book with absolutely no tension. So I had to go back and I had to think about, okay, what could be a motivating force here? And I think I still ended up with the book that I wanted it to be without spoilers. But at the same time, now there's a really wonderfully defined villain and I can't imagine it any other way now.
I mean, you had me at God Hunting Hounds, yeah. Which is would motivate anyone to kind of do things quickly, I feel.
I almost got rid of them in the final draft, so that's good to hear. I am a ruthless editor and I pull things apart and I'm like, oh, I think I have a way to get rid of that. And my editor was like, just stop it, Will. Walk away. It's great.
Well, Will, I mean, on this, I mean, how did you approach the writing of Monuments and why did you want to challenge yourself with writing a duology, but not only a duology, but also a fantasy duology? I mean, it's very different to the contemporary reads we've come to know you for.
But every book, I challenged myself in some way. With the first third, it was very much me wanting to be personal after my first book, Loathing Lola, was written when I was 17. And you can tell that's the work of a 17-year-old. It's just boob joke, fart joke, typo. And so with the first third, I put a lot of myself on the page and, you know, I wrote things that scared me. And I knew with, say, the sidekicks, I wanted to write a book that had three different voices who weren't my own and sort of try to craft characters in a way that I hadn't before, when earlier they had just been surrogates for me. And with Monuments, I'm like, okay, what's the next sort of challenge? Yes, fantasy writing was a challenge, but it was also a release for me because I was coming off the back of The Sidekicks, which was a book ruminating on my best friend passing away when I was in high school. And that was a harrowing experience to write. Like, I think I overestimated my capacity to sort of dip my toe into my high school memories and write about what it was like to lose someone and then rebuild myself in those formative years and really think about the effect that that had on the writer I became and also the person. And so while writing fantasy was a challenge and I learned something every day and it was incredibly humbling, it was also a release for me because it was like, I don't have to write characters who are sitting around crying yeah. and sort of performing their misery. Like, that didn't have to be a plot line, and that was really freeing. I could go back to the things that I absolutely loved as a kid. Like, you can see their influences in there. Yes, you can see the fantasy novels, but you can also see, do you remember the TV show Alias?
Yes.
Jennifer Garner, like that, you know, them getting dressed up in outrageous outfits, like that is an Alias montage. And, you know, all that stuff I really, really, really loved. And so I put all that in there. And so this was a way of me to just make a list of what were the things I was passionate about in school. Okay, how can I work that into a story that ultimately is fun and joyous and light? And while, yes, there's some heaviness in Monuments, I wanted the overall feel to be just a rollicking page turner.
So what do you think was the hardest part for you in writing this novel?
Oh, do I have to just name one? Look, I'm never going to write time travel again. That's a nightmare. And some of my favorite novels deal with time travel and they deal with it in different ways. And because I'm such a big editor, once you start editing with time travel, then things get really tricky because I'm dealing with one small change I make on one timeline ricochets throughout. So I have to really really be confident in my decisions before I start, and I'm not confident in my decisions before I start. I usually write two drafts and then realize, oh, that's what sucks about this manuscript, and then having to go back and pull it apart. And time travel just made that so much more difficult. So no more time travel ever again.
You say that now, Will.
I know. We have a sequel. Yay.
But in terms of, I mean, doing something like this that is outside of your comfort zone in a way, I mean, what do you think you learn about yourself? And I mean, did you have a Connor moment in this?
I reckon I realized that I always told myself, oh, I'm not good enough to write this kind of story. And the whole process of writing Monuments was me. There was that voice in my head that kept saying, you can't do this, can't do this. Okay, go back to the well, write another contemporary. You've got one in the bank. Just use that one. I had to sort of learn, much like Connor does, to sort of stand on my own two feet and believe in my abilities, because the whole sort of thesis of Monuments is that we all have the ability to be something special. Like, we can all be gods, and we have the power to change the world and remake it as we see fit. And it's our obligation to use that power wisely and morally. And, you know, not to say that I think I'm changing the world, but writing this book, I was suddenly aware of the power that I have when I'm writing, if that makes sense. And so
yeah,
I took that obligation.
So do you think that that's a theme that came out maybe unexpectedly, is you know, Connor's quite young in this. And I mean, we've all been at that stage where we're not, you know, we're losing our friends. We're not really sure what's happening. We don't know what that means to us, who we really are. That there was something in there that you wanted to say to someone who might be at that age right now, going through exactly the same experience, that they could take away from kind of seeing what Connor goes through, or relating to different things, whether they're the Sally or the Lockie in the story.
Yeah, I really just wanted everyone to know that, and to quote the amazing philosopher Little Kim, whatever don't kill you can only help build you. And that's completely true. Like, when we meet Connor at the beginning of the book, he is somebody who wants to run away from all these problems. He's skipping class to avoid his friends. He is running away from, there's sort of a simmering family issue with the grandfather that he's not really thinking about, let alone talking about. And he slowly sort of learns to come back to that and face that, because I think for a lot of people, and especially it seems to be the sort of climate that we have now, where if there's someone you disagree with or something that you violently dislike, it's just a matter of, I'm going to walk away and ignore it and it doesn't exist. Whereas Connor sort of steps up and he's like, no, I need to actually face these things. And so throughout the book, he sort of builds up the courage to, at least with his grandfather, sort of go back and sort of right that wrong.
And Will, I mean, what do you hope readers take away from Monuments, you know, once they read that last page and you leave them hanging until August next year?
Well, I hope they hurriedly go and pre-order the sequel and buy Monuments for all their family and friends, because I'd like to eat dinner tonight. No, I just want them to sit there and think, okay, I have the power to change the world. What will I do to make this place a better place, not only for me and my family, but for the generations that come next?
And Will, you mentioned, obviously, I mean, it's a duology, so there is a second book there. Mm-hmm. It does come out next year, and I understand you're in the middle of it at the
moment. Yes, I'm writing it. Keep mentioning the release date. That is not giving me hives at all.
No, that's okay. Happy to add to your anxiety on this.
Yeah, I always imagined it as sort of, there's the one book, which is the huge adventure, and the second book is that after the adventure, what happens to life afterwards? And it's sort of them trying to pick up the pieces, find their rhythms again, but also there are a couple of threads that are left open, challenges they have to face. But I'm really excited because you actually get to see them challenge the status quo and really work to change the world, because no spoilers, but we leave Connor, Lockie and Sally in a place that's very different to how we find them.
This is Rhianna Patrick on ABC Radio.